The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guests today on Getting to Yes And are Monica Warline and Jane Dutton. Monica is the CEO of EnlivenWork. She is a research scientist at Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education and Executive Director of Compassion Lab. Jane Dutton is the Robert L. Kahn Distinguished University Professor of Business Administration and Psychology and co-founder of the Center for Positive Organizations at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. She is also a founding member of Compassion Lab. Monica and Jane are the co-authors of Awakening Compassion at Work, The Quiet Power That Elevates People and Organizations. Monica and Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
So I booked you both on the podcast prior to reading your book, as you've been recommended to me by our friends at the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth. So I was pretty thrilled when I got to chapter 6 and you begin the chapter with the following quote: "In the world of work, compassion is expressed in action. Our research has uncovered the fact that compassion at work is largely improvisational." And that's what this podcast is exactly about. But before we get to that, I'd like you to lay the groundwork for something that I don't think gets talked about enough, which is simply to recognize the idea that suffering exists at work.
Absolutely, Kelly. We know that suffering is a pretty strong word, and some people don't associate it with workplaces. So if people out there need a substitute, you could think of pain or distress. Or these days, even the epidemic of stress at work. We think of those as forms of workplace suffering. And what our research shows is that difficulties in people's lives, like deaths and losses, can create suffering at work. But also, toxic relationships or difficult cultures or interpersonal conflicts in the workplace itself can create suffering.
Yeah,
Kelly, part of what we were trying to do with the book was also just to normalize talking about suffering at work, because in our research, we've learned that in many organizations, it's not safe to talk about it, even though suffering, pretty much everybody in the workplace is experiencing some form of suffering.
Yeah, I think it's an important word, and I like that, because I know stress is much more talked about work, but even there, a lot of bosses don't want to hear about it. But I think what you're showing is that when you acknowledge suffering exists in the human condition, and this is such an amazing thing to me that we all go to work and somehow they think that the human condition stops because it doesn't. and what it does, it, like, just thinking about this on sort of a human level, that actually there is there's like a bottom line cost to not recognize suffering, right?
Absolutely right. And it's measurable. In fact, some organizations have measured millions and millions of dollars in costs just related to grief in the workplace that isn't met with compassion.
And Jane, I want to ask you about this, because when you have silence around suffering at work, that creates an especially toxic atmosphere, right?
Yeah, the silence can amplify the level of suffering that people experience, and it creates a sense of lack of safety in the workplace, safe to be yourself, to be sort of fully there, which also has downstream costs as well. So if it's a place that you cannot express your suffering, it's often a place where you cannot experiment, be creative, take risks, all kinds of things.
Okay, so that then leads us to this idea of compassion, and not something that everyone thinks about when they sort of are looking at the important aspects of the workplace. But in fact, it's incredibly important. And you guys write, quote, "When seeking to build high-performing organizations that meet the challenges of a 21st century work environment, compassion matters more than most people recognize." Talk to us about that.
Well, we did a lot of work to gather up evidence from a bunch of different academic disciplines to show that when people feel that they work in a more compassionate work environment, the organization itself is able to bounce back more quickly from financial downturns. It's able to be more innovative and compete better in terms of innovation capability. It's able to deliver better service quality to its customers or care quality to its patients. And it's able to recruit and retain talented people more easily. So there are all kinds of reasons at the level of the organization's performance and its strategic advantage. Compassion is a key metric that we think executives aren't looking at closely enough.
And Jane, I want to follow up with you on that, too, because there's also the idea that compassion can make strategic advantages more sustainable. And I think that's really important to businesses because you don't want just to have one success. You want to sustain success.
Yeah, I think what our research suggests is an organization or a unit in an organization that is competent in terms of compassion is able to bounce back more quickly, and it's inevitable in all organizations. There's going to be dips in performance, but also dips in different capacities of the organization. And compassion is like a healing force that allows an organization and the people in it to recover more quickly from inevitable setbacks, which is why it becomes sustainable over time. It's like one way to think about it is an organization that is competent and compassionate is like a healthy body. And when a body gets wounded or an organization and the people in it get wounded, a healthy body will heal more quickly. And so compassion can be thought about as a healing force that allows a set of individuals to recover from more quickly from setbacks and other kinds of wounding that are inevitable part of the experience in any organization.
I really like that framing, the idea of competent compassion, because it's somehow, I don't know, the word compassion alone, I think, scares people. I think it sort of, you know, especially, look, I mean, the national conversation as we're taping this podcast right now is all about compassionate communication or the lack thereof, right? And it's sending everyone into a crazy tizzy, in part because we don't talk about it. But if you really look at it as just like a core competency, that might sort of destigmatize and allow for those occasional mistakes that happen in communication for you to recover from more quickly.
Yeah, you know, Kelly, it's really important that we acknowledge that compassion can be done with more or less competence, and that's true between people, and it's also true across groups and organizations. So we have found that organizations can become much more competent at doing compassion on a broader scale when they pay attention to the networks and the quality of connections between people, and they pay attention to things like roles and routines and values and how those support compassion. But I do think that connecting the ideas of competence and skillfulness and compassion is one important message that we are delivering. So compassion is not just equivalent to being nice. We have a very strong definition that we think about when we think about compassion, and we think, and that helps us show how it can be done with more skill.
The idea that I really was struck by was this idea that you say was noticing, all right? In the language of improvisation, we talk about being present, and I think it's very, you know, sort of equated. And you quote Max Bazerman, who says, quote, he equates becoming a great leader with becoming a first-class noticer. So what does it mean to notice?
Well, as you said before, when you were talking about how organizations expect us to somehow drop the human condition when we walk in the door of work, we often face expectations at work that we won't have emotions there, or that professionalism will mean that somehow we're more like machines than human beings. And so noticing suffering at work is the first part of compassion, and it's much harder than people think. We kind of take it for granted that we would know when other people are in pain around us. But so much of our workplace cultures diminish our capacity to express emotions or talk about what's happening in our lives. And so we think noticing does mean making yourself present and paying attention to the small signals that are coming from people around you, and also investing in getting to know people and their typical patterns, because oftentimes suffering will show up in minor deviations from a typical pattern, like someone who's normally outgoing is a little bit more quiet than usual, or somebody who's always on time starts to be late. And when that's happening, we can easily slip into kind of blaming them or overlook it altogether. But in fact, if we're noticing carefully, those are often signals for us to inquire about whether something's happening that needs our concern and our care.
So, Jane, that's true, right? That this human beings themselves aren't always very good at letting other people know what they need or if there's a problem. We sort of mask ourselves. And then you move that into a work context, and that mask probably comes even thicker.
Yeah, it's the masks that we wear as individuals, but also the masks that other people put on us.
Right.
I think really make it more difficult to notice suffering in its sometimes faint signals. And this is where, again, the idea of improvisation can be connected to the compassion process, because our research has suggested sometimes noticing is a collective endeavor that's improvised as people sort of piece together sort of different clues and cues about how someone is doing and different kinds of inquiry that they use to find out. In fact, someone in my department just lost her dad this weekend, and today was a day in which we were in varying ways over email, but also in conversation, you know, trying to see, quote unquote, how she is doing, and trying not to be like overly intrusive, and yet trying to find out like how we can be helpful. So I feel like I'm amidst this collective improvised noticing, and it's really brilliant. And it makes it really an important, again, part of the capability for compassion.
What you're talking about too, in our sort of world of improvisation, is the context of an ensemble, right? So, you know, we sort of preach ensemble behaviors, which involve making your partner look good, having each other's back, that all voices are important within the group, and the group's voice is also a voice, but you know, it's sort of shared, and it does require you to have an immense ability to be others focused, which is not how most people behave every day. And when you do that, you are able to pick up on cues that otherwise mere mortals wouldn't. And that's why improv feels like magic from the audience, when really all it is very, very deep listening.
Yeah, deep listening and then skillful action in response to what you hear, which I think is another part of how we link improvisation to compassion. Because as people do that collective noticing and share the cues and clues to make sense of what's happening with another person and in their condition, they also dream up new ways of feeling concern for that person's well-being and figuring out what kinds of action would help to address or alleviate the suffering a little bit. And every episode of suffering is a little bit different. And so we don't have the same kind of repertoire of action for each instance of suffering that arises, we really, in order to do it well, have to listen deeply, pay close attention, and then figure out what actions that we want to take based on what we know about the person and their circumstances and how we could customize our action or improvise it in line with what would be best for them.
That's important. And Jane, I'm curious with you, because this is a conversation I've been having with my colleague at Chicago Booth, Heather Caruso, time and time again, which is you have these academic insights that are rich and hopefully true, but they change over time as more information becomes available. And the one thing that improvisation seems to provide you is a framework to adapt to that change in real time, both in the short term and the long term. And I always think about Danny Kahneman's work, and I feel like improvisation is that movement between system one and system two, that it gives you practice in thinking a different way, that it can allow you to sort of present and be in the world as it is right now, which is going to be different later.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting point. I feel, again, where organizations get caught and don't improvise is when they think they have one or two policies or one or two routines that can handle, the suffering that people may experience. For example, a loss of a family member or some kind of illness. And I think, what we've been really interested in is what is it about organizations that institutionalizes this openness to practicing in different ways? Like, how can you institutionalize an attitude of improvisation and skillful improvisation around human responses to suffering? So I think that's a real challenge.
Yeah,
some organizations are beautiful at it, actually.
Yeah, but it's not easily prescripted, right? Because you have a sort of a skill set of the individual, and then you have to have this sort of like organizational agility that I get. Probably becomes just incredibly difficult. I work in a place with 500 to 1,000 employees, or let's say 3,000 employees, but really it's around 500,000 at any given time. When you max, you're working with 100,000 or 500,000. That's got to be really tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, I think.
Go ahead, Dave.
No, I was going to say. I mean, the beauty and the complexity of this is you can think about, again, that agility at multiple levels. So you can think about the agility within a team, for example, your team that's involved sort of more locally in this larger organization. You could also think about agility at the unit level and at the organizational level. And I actually think we don't know enough yet about what level of where the most important sources of agility lie. I mean, at which level of the organization are you going to get, in some sense, the most return for how this creates compassion competence?
I wonder if it's between levels. I wonder if it's something inside the way that the levels speak to each other, because the sort of alignment and purpose idea that they need to be, they're not static ideas. So if you've got the ability to be able to have, we had this situation today that I can't go into detail with, but it was one of these situations where our values were tested as an organization, and we were able in a matter of 5 minutes to recognize that there's alignment from the ownership and CEO level to the people on the ground, simply because we shared a kind of a language together, and we could sort of quickly move that idea. Maybe there's something in that, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
One thing we have noticed in our research cases is that in organizations where leaders and people who are the top, quote-unquote, of the organization, the premium on knowing about suffering and give permission for people to act to address suffering, part of what that does is it enhances the whole system's ability and willingness to notice suffering, and it creates demands for people to communicate it about it across levels, as you mentioned. And so that can actually unlock a lot of improvisational resources as people pass information and ideas about how to act with compassion across levels.
Totally. All right. I want to talk to you about difficult conversations. So this is something that is coming up Like a lot. The calls we're getting into our Second City Works, our corporate division that does these kinds of workshops, the kind of conversations I'm having at the bar or, you know, at a coffee shop, center around seeming like mostly about our inability, seeming inability to have real difficult, complex conversation at work and elsewhere. What's at play there?
Well, we don't have a lot of places in our contemporary culture and life where we are doing the work of training ourselves to have more patience and more openness. And so part of what the neuroscience of compassion shows us that I think matters for how we handle difficult conversations is that if we aren't repeatedly teaching ourselves how to be in the midst of distress or difficulty or strong emotions and simultaneously cultivate a sense of presence and calm, then when we do get into a difficult conversation, it's very easy for us to get angry quickly, to shut down and stop listening quickly, and to become defensive or otherwise combative. And the conversation goes from being a conversation into being an argument. And part of what empathy researchers call that is empathic distress. That actually, instead of being able to hear someone's opinion or someone's difficult circumstances and just be concerned and able to sit with the distress and listen to it, we kind of catch their distress in a way, and we kind of lose it on our side as well, and that undermines the compassion process. So I do think that part of our personal work around developing our capacity for difficult conversations is to cultivate that ability to be in distress and to still remain present and remain focused and remain in touch with our own open-heartedness.
That's hard, right? I mean, so we go to our fear brain. It's like performance reviews. Who enjoys performance reviews? And I don't know. It's like saying who enjoys going to the dentist. And so, Jane, I'm curious let me tell you. So I want to tell you a quick story. And then, Jane, I want to get your sort of feedback on that. Maybe it's a clue or a nudge to what I'm thinking here. When I became producer of Second City, so this is in 1992 when I was very young, and one of my friends, who then became my wife, Anne, I went to her for advice. And I sort of said, so I'm getting this job. Do you have any advice for me? And the one thing she said, I will never forget, she goes, yeah, I'm going to give you one piece of advice, is that when you make a mistake, tell someone you're sorry. And not enough leaders do that. And if you do that as a regular basis, I think it will serve you well. It has served me incredibly well over time. And I've just found it opens the door to a much better level of communication, to better trust, to building stronger bonds with people. And usually it's in the wake of me screwing up and doing something stupid.
Yeah, I mean, you probably know, or she knew implicitly about the research on apologies and how important, you know, what important healer that is of human relationship. And I think that even though apologizing or saying I'm sorry seems like a small act, it is part of the weave or creating the weave between people and organizations that sort of affects the quality of the connective tissue between people. And as we've talked about in our book, that the quality of connections between people sort of yields positive results at all stages of the compassion process, in noticing, in feeling, in responding, in interpreting. And so I think if you think about the incidents that would cause you to say I'm sorry as potential fractures or potential wounds, or tears in that fabric, by that small but consequential gesture of saying I'm sorry, you're reweaving and probably, again, as you suggested, increase the amount of trust and the potentiality in that fabric to yield other important benefits.
Yeah, there's an improvisational orientation around seeing all obstacles as gifts. And I do believe it's that particular mindset that allows a lot of us to sort of play with our own failures and make those part of the story and conversation. And I also think from a comedy aspect, a humor aspect, what we all know is that, like, everything going right is a terrible story. It's not funny. So, you know, we tend to, even exaggerate our own failures or our mistakes. And when that's sort of laid out in the open like that and it to be played with, it turns out to be kind of healthy, too, I think.
You know, one of the underappreciated findings that we have in our research and other people show it, too, is that a group or an organization that is able to be more playful on a day-to-day basis is also more likely to be compassionate because of the kind of things that you're talking about, that it's easier to treat failures as opportunities to learn, and it's easier to have a sense of humor with each other and to be forgiving when people make mistakes.
So I'm just curious, and I'm going to ask you each for a yes and story in a second. But before we do that, I'm very curious from a sort of professional services sort of POV, ideas of playfulness and compassion in the past, in my experience working with business clientele, didn't always go over so well. That wasn't really necessarily a conversation that people wanted to have. I see that changing a bit. I'm not going to say it's changed. I don't think it has. But I'm curious what you guys have seen with regard to that in contemporary business involving these kinds of ideas in their training.
Oh, I do think it's changing. I do think that that we're in the age of artificial intelligence, and we're seeing the disruptive capacity of technology all over the place. And that is a big part of what's drawing people's attention to the need for more humanity and more playfulness and more empathy and compassion between people. So as we see more artificial intelligence and automation and all of these things that we're talking about as the trends driving the workforce and the workplace, we also simultaneously see the need for embracing deeply human ideas like play and compassion.
Wouldn't it be funny if the robots were responsible for, like, reclaiming our shared humanity?
we're on the road already.
Awesome. Look what they did as well. All right. So the podcast is called Getting the Yes and what we ask all our guests, and Monica, you're going to be up first, is for a yes and story, a time in their life when they probably would have said no, but instead they said yes and what happened. And it could be anything. It could be personal. It could be work. I'm wondering if you've got a yes and story for us.
I do. It was in my middle 20s, and I was invited by a former university professor who I had known as a college student to come and sit in on one of his classes and observe this new class he was offering. Mm-hmm. And he had been a kind of friend when I was a college student. So I did that, and I absolutely hated the class. And when I had to talk with him about it afterwards, I had to make a decision about how honest I was going to be about my response to the way the class had run. And so when he asked me my opinion, I took a deep breath and I just said, you know, I think it might be way more impactful if you were able to try X, Y, and Z. And to his credit, his first response was, wow, why don't you come and teach it with me next semester? Mm. And I had this big lump of fear in my throat when I heard that, but I also felt that it was such an invitation. I was kind of inclined to say no because I had such a strong critique, but said yes, and that really brought out my love of teaching and is part of what carried me into graduate school and into this compassion work.
Oh, I love it. That's great. Jane, do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah. Oh, Monica, I love that story. I had not heard that. Mine is a professional one. It's one thinking back when a donor to our Center for Positive Organizations made a bid and so sort of said, yeah, I would I'm not sure I really want to give money to positive organizations, scholarship. What I'd really like to give money to is the idea of positive business. And I remember in my mind going, oh, no, that's not going to work. I mean, a thousand reasons to say I don't think that will work. But I thankfully didn't say any of that. I used that as an invitation to think with him about, well, what would it mean if we really tried the business school to sort of think about a frame of positive business? And actually, I wasn't the only one in the room. There were other people in the room as well. And we did this riff off of positive business. And I'm telling you now, 4 years later, we're having our fourth annual positive business conference that is a wonderful success for the Ross School. And it would never have happened if this gentleman had not suggested positive business. And if we, as me as an individual, but also we as a group, hadn't answered with a yes and possibility. So it's generated all kinds of good things.
Monica Warline and Jane Dutton, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I've been working in a home.